over his lovely catalog, and then kick ourselves when the prices come. And he's going to talk about how those prices got this way. Don't forget, there's a pattern to this morning's talks, and those who figure it out get something. I don't know. Kurt, thank you very much.
Thank you. Those of us who are speaking don't know anything about a pattern of talks, but I do know one thing, that we have successfully so far delayed the program 15 minutes, and if I can do it another 15 minutes, then that means I'll win everything I bid on out there on the table. So that's where we're going. I thought we'd do something a little bit different, and besides, since we are meeting at the University of Pennsylvania, if you think that you're going to get out of this conference without taking an exam, then you got another thing coming. And I've got just the exam for you. Before I have that handed out, however, I want to make sure that everybody understands the rules, Mike Beal. I am going to show some records, and I don't want to hear any comments, any grunts, groans, snickers, or anything, any noise or movement of any sort to give anything away, because this is for the money. In other words, the people who ace this quiz will be put into a drawing for a $50 gift certificate off of my website. Only Knox gives you this many ways to win. All right. Did you start my timer, or do I just, is it just go to always read that I have an hour? Okay, wait. It just turned to 59, so. How about that? All right. Because we have a large hall, nobody's going to be able to see real close at the objects that I brought, so I also have transparencies here that I'm going to use. Go ahead, Steve and John, if you would pass out the exams. Once this is over, if I could have a volunteer to get a copy of this over to the old quiz file, that would help out future students, I'm sure. What we're going to do is going to go through 10 records, and these records are in no particular order. And I'm going to describe the record to you, tell you what condition it's in, not using my grading scale, which some of you may not be familiar with, but just a straight 1 to 10 scale, with 10 being the best or perfect, and 1 being or 0 being unplayable. And you're going to fill out this exam ranking each of these 10 records in order of value in the collector market today, all right? At the end of my presentation, we'll grade those quizzes, and if you have aced that quiz, then write your name on it, turn it in to me, and then I will announce the winner at the banquet tomorrow night. Go ahead and turn on the projector. I got the first transparency up there. It's on the top. All right. The first record that we're going to look at is an Edison Blue Ambrol cylinder.
This is by Albert Farrington, Edison Blue Ambrol 2487. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, and this is in really nice shape, so I gave that a 9. It has the original box and lid. After the lecture is over, you're welcome to come up here and look at these, though you are not welcome to handle them.
we gotten to a Bikini Cylinder yet?
Yeah.
Is that next?
That's next, yes.
Okay, Bikini Cylinder, unknown, with a box.
A fake box. A fake box.
Mr. Klinger, you were also banned to the corner. I am serious. I mean, I know it's too late to say that, but you should have gotten the message the first time around. Next record is Vernon Dalbert, Parts of Roadstone on Black Patty by Blue Ridge Mountain Home, and Vernon Dalbert by himself on the other side, Barbara Allen. And I believe our last record is Black and Silver Brunswick Label by Harry James, Corporal Frank Sinatra, Melancholy Mood on one side, From the Bottom of My Heart on the flip side. Okay. Everybody, I assume, saw that or saw the overheads. You've got just to give you another 30 seconds or so to finish ranking these. And then put them aside. When I say it's over, I don't want anybody writing on their forms any longer, including while I'm talking.
Is the ranking in the collector market or among these? In other words, are we going to be 1 through 10, or could we have 2 fives?
Do 1 through 10. Okay. If there are ties in these records, then that'll be accounted for. But just do. Everything will have a unique number, 1 through 10.
Should we date these?
Excuse me?
Should we date them?
Yes, I want your last name first. I want to be able to read.
Extra credit for the
No extra credit on this one.
Okay. Everybody about done?
No. People are sharing pencils.
Sam? I've got an Earthlink window up here. Can you get rid of it for me? I don't know where your mouse buttons are on this thing. So, I mean, I don't know what works as a mouse.
This is the same. Ed had the same problem. It won't come back, we don't think. But I'll leave.
Okay. All right. Okay. We'll go ahead and take this down.
I think that the time is up. You don't know it now, you don't know it.
If you want to turn down the lights just a little bit, if you can turn them towards down towards the back, that'd be great. Okay. Before I begin my lecture, I want to define exactly what I mean by vintage record. A vintage record is any cylinder, 78 RPM disc, or any other grooved recording made before 1960, not including microgroove 33 RPM LPs and 45s. So I'm going to be talking about 78s and cylinders, not LPs, 45s, and CDs. Some of the things that I say might apply to other formats. But you need to understand at the outset that the vintage record market is very different from the microgroove market. As you can see from our quiz, determining the value of a vintage record is not always as straightforward as it may seem. Though many things can influence the value of a recording, there are four factors that are of primary importance: label, artist, condition, and demand. Let's see if I know how to do this. All right. The first factor is the record label. The label name and the catalog number will generally tell us whether or not a record is an original issue. Original issues are worth generally much more than later reissues. For instance, there were many early jazz performances originally issued on the Paramount label, which can command hundreds of dollars, and were later reissued on the UHCA label, and those typically are only worth a few dollars. Repressings are also typically worth less than original pressings, so label variety might be important. Now, anything that I say today is going to have instances which contradict what I've just told you. For instance, looking at original versus reissues. If an original recording is relatively common in its original form and was later reissued by a company on using the original metal parts on much cleaner shellac or vinyl, then that record will have more value than the original copy. Likewise, sometimes a repressing might be worth more than original pressing because just the way collectors feel about it. So if you have a Two Black Crows record on Columbia Blue Wax, even though that's a much later repressing, it's typically going to sell for one that's an original pressing on black wax. Or maybe you might have a record on the Victor Scroll label that originally came out on the Victor Wing label, and collectors are more enamored with the Scroll label, and so it's just going to sell for more. So those are some exceptions. There are some instances where a record is going to have value based solely upon the label. For instance, any Edison needle cut record in excellent condition is going to be worth $50 regardless of who's on it. But in most cases, performers are equally important in assessing the value of a record. Generally speaking, the more popular an artist was, the more records that person sold. And of course, the more they sold, the more that are available today. And the more that are available today, the less valuable those records are going to be. So records performed by artists that the average baby boomer has heard of are generally not going to be valuable. And that, of course, includes Caruso and Glenn Miller and Bing Crosby and the like. But of course, there are exceptions to this rule as well. Some artists are more collectible than others, so 78s by people like Hank Williams or Elvis Presley, even though they're common labels, will still bring $20 or more in excellent condition. Additionally, the very first recordings made by artists who are unknown at the time can often command excessive prices. So examples of that would be Hank Williams on the Sterling label, or Elvis Presley on Sun, or Lawrence Welk on Jeanette. All of those records will bring hundreds of dollars or more. Realtors will tell you that the value of a piece of property is gauged by three factors: location, location, location. And antique appraisers will tell you that the value of an item is also determined by three factors: condition, condition, condition. And so it is with old records. A record worth $100 in excellent condition may only be worth $1 in poor condition. So condition is the third critical factor. Our exception to that, of course, is that not all records, just because they're totally worn out, are going to be worthless. It turns out that there are some records that are so rare that they are unknown in good condition. And even if they're totally wiped out, they'll still command very high prices. This is particularly true with rare blues records that were recorded during the Great Depression, some of which had press runs of fewer than 50 copies when they were first made, so the number of extant copies is very small, and in many cases, no extant copies are known. Now, the last piece of information necessary to establish the value of a given recording is certainly the most important, but it's not one that can be determined by looking at the record itself, and that, of course, is market demand. I encounter records on a regular basis that may be unique, or certainly the only copies that I've ever heard of, but that doesn't make them valuable. It may very well be that the only person who cares about the recording of Joe Schmo on the Mercury label is his son, Joe Jr. On the other hand, Vogue picture records are very common, but they are widely collected, and so typically they have values of a minimum of $20 going up from there. I want now to discuss the value and collectability of different types of vintage records. I had hoped to bring a large selection of things to illustrate my talk with, but I had to fly in, and we were very, very late getting to the plane, and as it Turns out I couldn't check any baggage, and so I was consolidating things in the back of the car as Diane was racing to the airport. But nevertheless, I think you'll get the idea. The first category that I want to look at is jazz, blues, Cajun, and country records made from 1925 to 1935. There's more collector interest in these types of vintage records than any of the categories that I'm going to be discussing. As a result, rare records in these genres typically are going to bring higher prices than the records that will come later. And there are a number of reasons why records in these categories will bring those kinds of prices. The primary reason is that records in these genres were directed towards people on the lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder. Blacks, Cajuns, and hillbillies, poor rural folks, and tenement dwellers were the primary market for these recordings. Middle-class white folks generally weren't buying records of this nature because there really wasn't much cultural crossover in mainstream music until well after World War II. And the fact that the target audience was dirt poor is one reason why race and country records are so valuable. Another reason is that records purchased by poor people were purchased in order to be listened to. If you're making a dollar a day and you spend 75 cents on a record, you want to hear that record. Whereas a middle class person might buy a Caruso record to demonstrate their good taste. A poor farmer is buying a Carter Family record because he wants to hear it. Another factor is that new phonograph needles also cost money, and these people, these lower income families, often couldn't afford them. So they would reuse old needles, removing and reinserting them in the record reproducers, or even using old nails and sewing needles. And of course, this quickly stripped the peaks off the groove walls. And that is why jazz, blues, Cajun, and country records are so hard to find in good shape. And another factor accounting for the scarcity of these records is World War II. During World War II, shellac was a scarce commodity, and there were big shellac record drives, and hundreds of thousands of records were melted down for the war effort. But in spite of the fact that these records can be very valuable, this is still the category that you are most likely to find valuable records in, and that's simply because there were just so many different titles and labels issuing this type of material over this period of time. So just the fact that, you know, the numbers were there to begin with in toto, it means that we're going to find more of those today. All right, the next group that we're going to talk about are early rock and roll, black gospel, and rhythm and blues from the 1950s. Collectors of post-war recordings are probably more particular about the condition of a record than collectors of any other vintage record category. The difference in value between a near-mint copy and one in just average condition can be dramatic. Records that have been played on jukeboxes are frequently encountered, and they are usually worthless. These juked records are easily identified because one side is totally worn out and the other side is unplayed. Another consideration affecting the value of records in this category is the fact that beginning around 1950, records were often available in more than one format, 78 RPM, 45 RPM, EP, or LP. Records made before 1955 are typically worth more as microgroove recordings, and those recorded after or made after 1955 are usually worth more as 78s. And that's because 78s were still the dominant format in the early 1950s, but by 1960 they had been phased out. There is a lot more interest in 78 RPM recordings in the 1950s today than there was even 5 years ago. It used to be you couldn't even give away hardly a lot of rock and roll stuff in 78 format, but today it's become quite collectible. The next category we're going to discuss are early discs made before 1905 or thereabouts. The very first disc records sold in the United States were 7 inches in diameter, single-sided, and they were made by Emil Berliner. These records are typically worth a minimum of $100 in excellent condition. In fact, I have literally owned thousands of Berliner records, and I can probably count on one hand the number of records, Berliners, that I've seen in excellent condition, as I would grade excellent. Other types of early single-sided records are also usually worth $10 or $20 minimum in excellent condition. But that's not true for all small records. Little Wonders, for instance, are 5 inches in diameter. They were recorded much later. And they are very common, and they're typically only worth $1 or $2. And the same holds true for most small kiddie records that you'll find that were recorded in the teens or 20s. Early records larger than 7 inches can also be quite valuable, but bear in mind that most single-sided 10-inch and 12-inch recordings made after around 1905 are not valuable, unless they have something else going for them. The next category is spoken word recordings by historical figures and personalities. This is a very specialized field because most people don't like to listen to speeches and interviews over and over. But these recordings do provide a very real link to the past, and for this reason they appeal to a number of collectors. Sports-related recordings enjoy a certain degree of crossover popularity and may bring more from a sports collector than a record collector, and you'll find that to be true in a number of different areas. For instance, political records and records made by movie stars are often more valuable to political collectors and so forth. Next group is picture records. Picture discs were first made in the early 1920s, and due to their eye appeal, they are a very popular nostalgia collectible today. Grooveware is generally second to the visual condition of the record for most collectors. Vogue picture records were made during 1946 and 1947 and are the most widely collected picture records. And that holds true even for people outside of the United States. Super rare picture discs can be extremely valuable. Last year, I sold a complete collection of Vogues, and they brought $85,000. That was, I don't remember how many records it was, maybe 100. But $75,000 of that value was tied up in only 10 records. So Vogues have a big audience. Not nearly as big as jazz and blues, but they are bringing prices above and beyond most anything else, at least the expensive things, the rare things. The next category is advertising, promotional, special purpose, and test records. This is kind of a catch-all category. Advertising and promo records are very often fascinating, but they usually don't have a great deal of value. Pre-1910 special pressings and unusual recordings by famous personalities are exceptions. Test pressings are recordings pressed by record companies to evaluate the quality of a studio performance for ultimate release. If the recording was not commercially issued, the test pressing could be very valuable if it's recorded by somebody of significance. Tests usually have blank white labels with handwritten information. About 2 years ago, an antique dealer in Wisconsin stumbled across, or somebody brought a box of records into his antique booth, and he bought them, and he probably paid next to nothing for them. There were about 50 records total. I took those records from him, and after a couple of months of research with other collectors, we determined that this was an extremely important find. It consisted of unissued, both matrices and takes, of rare blues, jazz, and hillbilly music recorded by Paramount and QRS. I listed these records in Vintage Record Auction 30, and they sold for almost $50,000 individually. Special pressings of commercially issued records were often made for radio station use, and these are typically termed disc jockey pressings. And although some may be more valuable than their corresponding commercial issues, most have no exceptional value. All right, let's see if I can get rid of this thing. I can get the. Okay, now what do I press? This one? For my next act. This has one of those little mouse buttons in between the keys, and I don't do those. All right, where were we? Okay, next category is unusual sizes. This is also kind of a catch-all thing. Basically, any records larger than 12 inches in diameter are worth checking out. 16-inch discs were used by radio stations and are called radio transcriptions, or ETs. Early radio discs were usually destroyed or thrown away, and some radio shows exist today only because employees surreptitiously liberated them from the radio stations where they worked. Even so, most post-war ETs are of no great value, especially since collectors usually aren't able to play them. Radio stuff from the 30s and earlier can be quite valuable, even if it's just fragments of programs. Movie soundtracks from the late 1920s were also recorded on 16-inch discs, and these were meant to be synchronized with film elements. Any surviving examples of these records should be documented because they may be long-lost parts of movies or shorts. Most records smaller than 7 inches in diameter are children's records and are of no great value, but a few notable exceptions exist. Next group is rare labels. Like picture record collectors, label collectors are usually more concerned about the appearance of the label than the condition of the grooves. Only a relatively small number of persons diligently collect labels, so you can typically find rare labels for very reasonable prices. On the other hand, a record with a rare label that also contains a very highly sought-after jazz or blues performance is going to bring very high prices. Early prototype labels are extremely rare, particularly if they were made by one of the larger companies. Next category is early classical and operatic records made prior to around 1908. With certain exceptions, operatic and classical records recorded in the United States have minimal value. This includes the vast majority of Victor Red Seals and the banner or tricolor label Columbias that you see everywhere. Most album sets are also of little interest to collectors. I can say that because Pete Munvies didn't make it here today. What can be valuable are early and unusual recordings on European, Russian, and South American labels, such as Phonotypia, G&T, Zonophone, and Pathé. Since these records were generally not issued in the U.S., they turn up very infrequently here in the United States. Next group is Edison disc records. The name Edison still carries a certain mystique even in the 21st century. As a result, folks who find a stack of Edison records or an Edison phonograph typically think that they've stumbled across a gold mine. Unfortunately, this is seldom the case. Edison diamond disc records are a quarter inch thick. They were made from 1913 to 29, and most issues have very little value, even in pristine condition. And in fact, it's not at all difficult to find diamond disc records in pristine condition because there is an awful lot of unsold dealer stock that's circulated out there. With the exception of the very first issues, the earlier the Edison disc, the less desirable it is. Edison records made in the year or two preceding the collapse of Edison's phonograph division, however, are much more desirable, and the latest releases can be worth hundreds of dollars. Normal 78 RPM lateral cut Edison needle type 78s were made in 1929, and as I said before, all of those are valuable. Next group, oddball and technologically interesting records. This is one of my favorite areas of collecting. Commercially issued pre-war records designed to play longer than the typical 78 are usually collected as interesting artifacts of failed technologies rather than for the music recorded on them. Even so, they are worth substantially more than your average vintage record. Puzzle or multi-track discs are also collectible novelties. Again, few are worth a great deal, but they are all interesting. Records attached to cardboard cutouts and postcards are desirable. However, the record must be in good condition and the cardboard element needs to be intact. Next category, cylinders. Cylinders are a type of record that typically cause dollar signs to appear in the eyes of the uninitiated. In fact, as you know, it's not surprising to see moldy wax cylinders on the shelf of an antique shop priced at $10 or more. And that's not an attempt, generally, by an unscrupulous dealer to deceive the public, but simply a result of simple ignorance. Commercially recorded cylinders were made until 1929. They don't predate disc records, as most people believe. And as a format, they are quite common, though certain types and brands can be very valuable. Generally speaking, the rarest cylinders are the earliest, which would be roughly pre-1900, and also the latest, or post-1927. Pink and purple cylinders are worth a premium, as are cylinders of unusual sizes, with the exception of common 6-inch recording blanks. Standard cylinders in average condition can often be had for as little as $1 or $2 each. Since records often turn up in close proximity to phonographs, I thought it would be a good idea to touch on those as well. Up until the last few years, serious phonograph collectors wouldn't be interested in any machine that didn't have a horn on it. But that certainly has changed. In fact, just last year, a floor model Victrola sold for over $70,000. But don't run out and start buying every phonograph you see, because most inside horn wind-up machines are still only worth $200 to $500, and that assumes that they're in original, working, excellent condition. Most early electric phonographs have very little value, unless they were made before about 1930, but certainly over time those values will rise. Outside horn phonographs are usually worth around $500 to $1,000 as cylinder machines and about $600 to $2,000 as disc machines. Don't be fooled by the proliferation of cheap reproduction machines that are normally coming out of India. These are not so lovingly referred to as crapophones, and they're made from a mixture of old and new parts. Usually they don't work, and most phonograph repairmen will not even take them in on repair. With all due respect to George, I'm going to say that unlike phonographs, music boxes create music, they don't reproduce it. Like phonographs, they also come in both disc and cylinder varieties. Antique music boxes can be very valuable, but it is very easy to get stung. Bear in mind that the costs involved in repairing combs or cylinders will often exceed the value of the box once it's restored. Okay. Next thing, miscellaneous items, or ephemera. Yeah, throw this in for Steve. Anything related to vintage records and phonographs is collectible to one extent or another. That includes catalogs, needle tins, record dusters, nippers, and so forth. But be advised that there, again, are a great many fakes out there that are showing up in antique stores these days. Most have been made to look old and can fool even the most experienced collectors. Nipper dogs, phonograph catalogs, metal advertising signs, cylinder boxes, needle tins, and phonograph parts, even phonographs themselves, are all being reproduced by skilled craftsmen. On a personal note, I lost $10,000 buying a reproduction tinfoil machine about 8 or 10 years ago. It was perfect. It was also made in 1957. One thing many collectors overlook are record cabinets. Disc record cabinets look similar to sheet music cabinets, but typically the slots are either vertical or they're smaller. They often have slide-out shelves, drawers to keep accessories in, and or small cups for phonograph needles. Cylinder cabinets will have drawers or shelves filled with wooden or cardboard pegs, if the pegs are missing, as they usually are. You look for little rows of screw holes or circles of glue where they used to be attached. Record cabinets are often worth more than the phonographs they were designed to complement. Okay, now that we've covered vintage record values, let's grade your quizzes and see how you did. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start with lowest values, and we're going to work up to the higher ones. With a rank of 1 or 2 is the Glenn Miller Victor. This is a very common, very late pressing. Most big band records are virtually worthless. So we're going to say a value of $1 to $5 on this. Probably $5, because people do look for In the Mood. I mean, that's a very popular, recognizable song, and they like to play it on phonographs and jukeboxes. Okay, next record, as a with also a score of 1 or 2, is the Victor Caruso Red Seal. Like the vast majority of Caruso records, extremely common. A ranking of 3 or 4 is the Edison Blue Amberol. Most Blue Amberols, like I said, are $1 or $2, maybe $5 records. But this is a popular World War I song and an original box and lid, so we're going to say it's worth 10 to 15. I guess we did the diamond disc, didn't we? All right. There's a Blue Amberol with 3 and 4. Now I'll go back up to the diamond disc. Okay. It's out of order on my thing. Okay, the Edison Diamond Disc is a common but a snappy foxtrot, but it's in pristine condition. Most Edison discs are worth $1 to $5. We'll say this one is also worth $10 to $15. Next record is the Bettini Cylinder and Box. This is a worthless cylinder in a fake box. I could show you that without having to tell you, because Bettini never made a box that looked like that, okay? It's not that I was, it wasn't a trick question. It was obviously reproduction if you knew what real ones look like. Original Bettini boxes bring $100 to $1,000 or more, even without cylinders, depending on condition. But as a novelty, we're going to say this is worth $20 or $30, just from a box collector. A rank of 5 or 6 is the Clyde McCoy Vogue Picture Disc. This is the most common of all Vogues, the very first one, R707. Most Vogues will sell for $30 to $60 for average titles and average condition. This is an extremely common record in average condition, so we're going to say it's worth $20 to $30. Next, with a value of 7 or 8, is the Frank Sinatra Brunswick. This was Sinatra's very first recording, and it is scarce. Most other Sinatra records have little or no value. This one is worth $300 to $500. With a rank of 7 or 8 is Charlie and His Orchestra. This is a rare World War II German radio propaganda record. Extremely rare. Not very well known here in the States, but still worth $300 to $500. And so it leaves the last two, 9 or 10, the Vernon Dalhart Black Patty. An ultra-desirable, ultra-rare label with an ultra-common artist. Strictly a label item. But any Black Patty is going to be quite valuable. And also 9 or 10 is a Charlie Patton Paramount. Usual poor condition, but a very rare recording by a highly sought-after blues man. In fact, this last record was in my last auction, and it sold for, I think, $800-something. Though the high bid on it was, I think, $2,500, so he got it for a real bargain. I really expected that record would go for at least $1,000 to $2,000. Okay. To conclude my talk, I want to discuss the state of the hobby in general. People have been collecting records now for over 100 years, but it's only been within the last decade or so that record collecting as a hobby has really begun to mature. This is puzzling to me because phonograph records are very, well, they're easy to find, they're very difficult to fake, and you have the aural element to go along with the visual. And I just don't understand why they've never really taken on the air of a serious collectible like other things. I mean, music has a universal appeal, and I mean, everybody likes music, and my mentality can't get over why somebody doesn't like records. But there are an awful lot of them out there, as we all know. Furthermore, many recordings are of great cultural and historical importance. Like just about everything else, vintage record values have gradually risen over time. Unlike many other collectibles, however, prices are generally low. If you collect baseball cards or books or stamps or coins or comic books or posters, you're going to spend tens, if not hundreds of thousands, to get top drawer rarities. But top drawer vintage record rarities can typically be had for under $1,000. This is changing, and many of the records that I bought 10 or 15 years ago are worth a great deal more today. And where it used to be highly unusual for a vintage record to sell for over $1,000, this has now become a fairly regular occurrence. Last year, the only known copy of Zulu's Ball by King Oliver on Jeanette sold for $32,000. To my knowledge, that's the highest documented price paid so far for a 78. The day is coming when rare records will regularly sell for five or six figures. So what is the hottest category in vintage record collecting? Right now, it has to be pre-war blues. A very limited number of records are being chased by a growing number of affluent collectors. And as the rock generation continues to be interested in its roots, these values are only going to continue to go up. Early black jazz is strong, particularly jug and washboard bands. Rock and roll and R&B values, like I said earlier, have been rising rapidly. Late Edison diamond discs are bringing prices unheard of 5 years ago. And brown wax cylinders, pink Lamberts, and late Edison blue Amberalls are also regularly changing hands for hundreds of dollars. Picture records are weak, with the exception of rarities. Record labels and cylinder boxes continue to be collected by a small but dedicated handful of enthusiasts, but only the rarest of them bring high prices. Popular music and dance band records are still very affordable, and prices are stable. Country music values are rising, but not dramatically. Classical and operatic values haven't really changed much recently, but I expect them to eventually fall, and that's simply because there just aren't, I don't see a great deal of new collectors coming in to fill the shoes of the older ones who are passing. But again, extreme rarities will hold their value. Other categories, such as radio transcriptions, advertising and demonstration records, kiddie records and speeches, values will only rise as books and articles are written about them. Common acoustic recordings, big band, pop, sacred, Hawaiian, square dance music, and the like, have very little market value. Obviously, there are exceptions. Well, maybe not with square dance records, but... So my forecast for the vintage record market is for mostly sunny skies with scattered showers. Records that are truly rare will continue to rise in value, and as they do, condition will become more and more important. Desirable records in beautiful condition, even those that are not terribly rare, are going to skyrocket. But along with that trend will come a tightening of grading standards. Dealers who are unable or unwilling to accurately and honestly assess the true condition of a record are not going to survive. Now I want to talk about disposing of vintage records. If you have records to get rid of, you are faced with three choices. Throw them away, give them away, or sell them. Unless you have an above average collection or some nice individual pieces, you're going to have a very hard time selling them. Bear in mind that 95% of all records have little real value. Even stellar collections usually contain a vast quantity of items with no intrinsic worth. Common stuff stays common. Unless you have an extremely unusual collection, you're not going to be able to retire on the sale of your collection. You may be able to make a mortgage payment or take a cruise, but even that's generally unlikely. In my experience, not more than 1 in 100 records is worth more than $10. If you do have valuable records, you need to make plans for the disposition of your collection while you are able. Your heirs will probably have little interest in keeping the records, and they most likely won't have any idea how to get rid of them. Either make prior arrangements with a dealer or leave your family a list of names and phone numbers to contact. And it is just important to make a list of names and phone numbers of people that you do not trust. I want to say that I want to just make a comment because we're an archival, or many of us come from archives. I guess I can't say that we're an archival organization necessarily. But since we do have a lot of archives represented here, usually when I give this talk, I will tell people that archives are not going to be interested in their records, certainly not libraries and universities and so forth. And that, as you know, is very generally true. And many of the archives here don't want records, unless they happen to fall within the narrow scope of your collecting interest. Now, granted, some of your collecting interests are not so narrow. But if they aren't, you already have all the common stuff. You don't want a bunch more big band records. You only want what you want. And I wanted to say also that, just as an aside, when Jim Stewart was giving his presentation yesterday on the Johnson Victrola Museum, that is one archive which I am really, really impressed with. These are people who, starting out, they weren't collectors. They didn't really know what they were doing, but they've taken an interest in the subject, and they've learned a great deal, and their focus is to make this information accessible and as much of it visible to the public as possible. And they get out there in a marketplace, they fight for what they want, they go to the shows, they're down there with the other collectors, and I'm very impressed by that. And things that wind up in their collection are dealt with in a very responsible way. They are either taken care of, or they see to it that they find homes for those records. So often I see or hear of libraries or what have you, they just throw them out on the curb in the book sale. They have no idea what's there, nor do they care. And a lot of stuff, as you know, has just disappeared that way. So anyway, I just wanted to commend them for the great job that they're doing. And I'm very happy of that Philadelphia arrangement. I mean, that is exactly the way it should work. I mean, those records went to where they belonged. And if you, as an archive, have records that you need to get rid of, please do the legwork and find a place that really can use those records. And if there is no archive, then certainly get them into hands of collectors somehow. Okay, one more thing I want to mention concerning your estate, and again, this is directed specifically to those of you sitting here who are very interested in preservation issues. It does no good as a collector to transfer rare or unique recordings to a tape, CD, or hard drive if those transfers are not properly identified and their ultimate disposition is not predetermined. I can't tell you how many collections I've bought and there were boxes of cassettes or reel-to-reel tapes. I don't have the time or, in many cases, the knowledge to go through that stuff and determine what it is or where it belongs, and those things get thrown away. I have records. In my last auction, for instance, I had an extremely rare group of unique Western Electric type test pressings that were of historical importance. And like other records that I sell at that level, every one of those was scanned and transferred before they left or before they will leave my shop, because I feel like this is a collection that's never going to exist again, and trying to reproduce this will be impossible down the road. But along with those transfers, or just making the transfers, I'm not the only person who has a copy of them. If something happens to me or my building, those things are still going to exist, and they're going to be identified somewhere else. So perhaps even a better idea as a collector is, if you have material of that nature, and it doesn't necessarily have to be important, But I think rarity is the key thing. If you've got only one or two the only copy known of something that's just interesting, make a copy and give a copy to an institution who's willing to accept it. And I plan on making some sort of arrangements with an archive such that when I'm gone, those transfers that I've made of important things will be noted and put in a repository where they're going to be able to be used by others. All right. So, in closing, vintage records are a great deal of fun to collect. They can also be a very good investment if you cultivate your sources and buy wisely. Truly rare records in pristine condition have been increasing in value and show no signs of stopping. But don't count on your collection to see you through your retirement years, except as a reliable source of entertainment. Thank you. It would appear that one of my competitors has been in Sam's computer. I'm happy to answer questions. Okay, we do have time for that. Gary?
Kurt, the three Caruso cylinders, do they ever turn up in good condition? And if so, what do they sell for?
Caruso cylinders certainly do turn up in good condition, but they're like all Pathés of that period. They oftentimes can look perfect, but Pathés were made of a wax that has some sort of characteristic or composition where it can be virtually inaudible, even though it looks new. So I grade everything in my catalog visually, and if it plays a little better or worse than it looks, I'll make a note of that. But I find, for reasons I've discussed at prior ARSC meetings, that visual grading is much preferable over audible grading. But I will grade things orally if they are early Pathé cylinders or if they're brown wax cylinders, because there too you really have no idea how the recording is going to sound based on what the grooves look like. In terms of value, an original Caruso cylinder in an original box in using our numerical scale, say in a condition of 8, would be worth a couple $1,000s. And if it's a salon intermediate size or concert, then it would be worth more. Steve? Well, because record values have not been heavily speculated in, and I'm not talking, now again, remember, we're talking about vintage records. We're not talking about microgroove. Okay, microgroove records have been heavily speculated in, and that values have fallen precipitously for a number of things, but not vintage records yet. Okay, so if there's a large downturn or significant downturn in the economy, records may reflect that, but not nearly like other collectibles do. The nice thing about records, and what I enjoy about this business and about this hobby, is the fact that the people I do business with like old records. And that's significant. Gone are the days when you go to a coin show with your grandson and pour through V-nickels or something. I mean, yeah, you can do that, but a coin show today is a bunch of high rollers with big wads of bills, and this is just a commodity like everything else. Same thing with baseball cards, you know. But records, the people right now who are in the hobby love the music. They're doing this because they like the artifact, and that makes it fun. You don't have the number of sharks in it like you do in some of the other things. So it's not as tied into economic conditions. And certainly for me as a dealer, because my business is international, I'm much less affected by regional or even national economic situations.
That's what I was going to ask you about, what the effect on the international bidder is. I know that the Japanese economy...
So there's a myth that says, I got to sell everything to one person. That's usually not the way you're going to get the most money for your records. Because if that person now has to haul 10,000 records out that they don't want, then you're paying for that whether you know it or not. And you're not getting anything for those 9,500 records that he's hauling out. You may think you are, but you're not getting a dime for him. He's paying you for what he wants, okay? It's much better to sell what's valuable to somebody who knows what they're doing, somebody that you can trust, and then the balance of the stuff, after I go through a collection, if they want, I will give them a letter of appraisal on the rest of the collection. If they have 10,000 records left in the basement, then I'll give them an appraisal for $1.50 a record, which is a retail replacement value. Any of those records, if you wanted to go out and buy it from a dealer, you're going to have to pay $1.50 for it, maybe $2. Okay, so that's legitimate. And if they can find any tax-exempt organization, Salvation Army or Goodwill or a local public radio station, to take those records, then they're making a whole lot money on that donation tax-wise than they'll ever make trying to sell them, especially if they can also get that organization to haul them themselves. Ed.
Did the original Black Patty make any records herself?
No.
Sissy Redder Jones?
No. I mean, it's always possible somebody could have made a brown wax cylinder somewhere along the line, but that's not, as far as I know, even rumored. So, no. Next. Ethnic records, again, has a very niche-oriented market, and it's a bunch of different niches, obviously. So things, again, I'm speaking in very broad terms here, but German, French, Swedish, mostly Italian, not Jewish, but those things are typically of very little value. But Jewish records can be valuable. There's a pretty good contingent of collectors of that, as well as certainly things like African and Greek and Arabic and even Oriental, Latin records. The problem that I have in selling ethnic stuff is if it's not in a Western alphabet, how do I list it, you know? And so that's difficult. And I've got some pretty interesting things at home I really don't know what to do with. But that's for those certain areas that I mentioned, prices can be very high. And, you know, when I put it on, I'm as amazed as anybody at what something might bring because I don't know that stuff. Somebody else? Jim?
For many collectibles, eBay has depressed the prices for them. How has eBay affected the prices for vintage
collectors? For me, it hasn't affected anything. It may have even made things go up. I had people when eBay first came out say, "Oh, Kurt, what are you going to do? This will put you out of business." I said, "There's no way." I mean, I don't see how a person can spend the length of time it takes to go through. I put 10,000 records in a catalog. How long is it going to take you to go through 10,000 records on eBay? And every record is its own individual auction, its own invoice, its own check that you write, its only thing that's packed and shipped. I mean, it just boggles my mind. I can hardly get done what I do, but if I had to do every single thing by itself, that's crazy. And if you look at eBay and you look at who's bidding on these things and you look at the higher value stuff, you're going to see the same 20 people over and over. My catalog goes to 4,000 people in 50 countries. Most of these people don't do eBay. A lot of them probably don't have a computer. So, no. I mean, what eBay has done is it has created some new collectors. And once they get tired of the eBay routine and they find my website, then I've got a customer. I don't mean to knock the people who do eBay. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with it. I just can't see how you could make a living doing that. Some people do. And I don't see how you can really build a great collection doing that. Okay. Mike? That's a big problem. It really is. If you don't know what that record looks like, even a scan, you can't tell anything from that. I'm out, right?
Yeah.
I'm out. Okay, if anybody would like to ask questions later, I'll be happy to answer them, but I will leave the records up here so after the next presentation if you want to come up and look, you're welcome.
I didn't know when to jump in, but when Mike said the word grade, I figured I better get in. Kurt, thank you very much. your work sets a standard for many, and we've all learned from your catalogs and learned today as well. I'm happy to introduce another new attendee. Did you come to Los Angeles, to Santa Barbara?
Yeah.
And then Brian tried to get on the program then, and we were full up, so I'm very happy to have Brian and here to talk about the Pacifica Radio Sound Archive, I guess this country's oldest group of independent stations. Brian has recently become the archivist there, I say relatively recently. I won't talk about what you used. Well, I will talk about what he used to do. First time I ever talked to Brian, I think that I learned that the Pacific Archive had moved from Venice, California, to North Hollywood, and I told him that I had spent some time in North Hollywood in the